Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 8th of December 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 18 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. And the first episode in our brand new time slot here of 10 o'clock on Tuesday nights. So for those of you tuning in for the first time and wondering what is this thing called Reality Check, well, Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to cast our critical eye over the Dalai Lama. Can one man really be as good, wise, and compassionate as his public persona would lead us to believe? And is he really a sweet and loving grandfather to the LGBT community? Well, we'll peel back the veneer of saintliness that surrounds the Dalai Lama and have a peek at what lies beneath. Then, in our movie review section, we'll have a look at two new films that both push the boundaries of the horror genre, Paranormal Activity and Antichrist. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last 2 weeks. As there was no show last week because I was in Brisbane for the National Skeptics Conference, so there's actually quite a lot of news to get through tonight, and the show today has to be more streamlined than ever because we have to finish up by 11 o'clock for the next show, Sound Museum. So I think today we'll just do a brief rundown of the latest LGBT news. First up, let's return to Argentina to find out what's happened in the continuing saga of Alex Freire and José María Di Bello, who, back in mid-November, got a court order requiring the Marriage Registry Office in Buenos Aires to issue them a marriage license. And they looked like they were about to become the first ever same-sex couple to get married in Latin America, a region of 570 million people. When they went back to the registry office, they didn't get married then and there, but instead decided to set their wedding date for December the 1st, which actually gave their opponents time to launch counter-lawsuits and to try to stop the wedding from going ahead. And that's the cliffhanger on which we were left hanging 2 weeks ago. Would the wedding go ahead or would it be stopped? And I'm sorry to say, dear listener, that our worst fears were realized, and on November the 30th, just one day before they were due to get married, another court declared that the original court decision allowing same-sex marriage was invalid. So, sadly, when they arrived at the registry office on December the 1st, they were not issued with a marriage license and ended up protesting with several other people on the steps there for several hours. So, bad news there from Buenos Aires, unfortunately. Although Alex and Jose Maria are now appealing to Argentina's Supreme Court. So there's still hope that that we may see the first same-sex marriages being performed in Argentina within the next few months. And of course, the parliament there is still debating the issue, so fingers crossed that one of those roads will lead to marriage equality in Argentina in the very near future. And speaking of losses for marriage equality, another one occurred in the state of New York in the USA last Thursday, December the 3rd, when the state Senate voted against a bill that had been passed by the lower house and would have allowed same-sex marriage in that state. The vote was a very disappointing 38-24 against the bill, so a resounding defeat there for our side. And one that, according to some analysts, puts the nail in the coffin for marriage equality in New York, probably for the next couple of years at least. There were some angry protests in New York following the vote, but unfortunately they couldn't undo what had been decided. And speaking further of losses for marriage equality and resulting protests, we also had a loss here in Australia a couple of weeks ago, on November 26th, when a Senate inquiry that had been looking at the issue of same-sex marriage and had received over 28,000 submissions from various groups and individuals, making it the largest ever Senate inquiry in Australia, by the way. Anyway, the Senate inquiry issued a recommendation against introducing marriage equality in Australia. And I have to say, the report they handed down was really disappointing, because it gave no valid reason for rejecting same-sex marriage. Just a lot of pathetic hand-wringing about taking into account all the different views in society and all that kind of blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, not once did they ever explain why it was legitimate to deny a fundamental civil right to millions of people on the basis of the views of a small minority who will not be affected by the legislation in any way. So, a really pathetic job by the Senate committee there, in my opinion. Then, on the following Saturday, November 28th, thousands of people participated in rallies for marriage equality that were held all over Australia, condemning the Senate committee's decision and calling on the government to introduce same-sex marriage. Something that I suspect, unfortunately, won't happen here for many years. But all is not doom and gloom. Marriage equality is moving ahead in Washington, D.C., and they are going to vote on it within the next few days, on Thursday, I think, in New Jersey. And they've also started a debate on a type of civil unions bill in the Irish Parliament. So there is some progress happening amongst all these setbacks. Okay, as we're on a very tight schedule now on Reality Check, that's all the LGBT news we're going to have time for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll get into an examination of whether the Dalai Lama really is as sweet and adorable as the media so often makes him out to be. For example, did you know that he's not actually vegetarian, although he only eats meat every second day? To find out much, much more about him, and not all of it good, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Someday Soon by Natalie Bassingthwaite. Okay, now we move into the part of the show where we normally get into a skeptical analysis of a topic related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But today we're going to do something slightly different and look at one person in particular. one who is often surrounded by an aura of mysticism, at least in the way he's presented in the media. And we're talking, of course, about the Dalai Lama. I should also mention briefly that I went to the Australian Skeptics National Conference in Brisbane last week, and I recorded some material there, and I will report back on what happened at the conference, but I think I'll do that next week, because I thought that today, given that the Dalai Lama is in Melbourne right now, today, well, we'd devote to him, and we'll come back to Brisbane next week. So did you know that the Dalai Lama is in Melbourne at this very moment? He's actually here attending what's called the Parliament of the World's Religions, what they're calling the world's largest interfaith event, which has been taking place every few years in different places around the world since 1993. And so hundreds of international religious celebrities have descended on Melbourne, including former US President Jimmy Carter, Reality Check favourite His Holy Eminence Cardinal George Pell, and of course the Dalai Lama, who is pretty much the headline act for the whole shebang. And while the local media have been going gaga over everything that His Holiness says or does, I thought it might be an opportune moment to cast a critical eye over the Dalai Lama himself and try to catch a glimpse of the reality that lies beneath all the hype. Because I'm sure you've noticed how the world's media, well, with the obvious exception of the Chinese media, of course, and anyone in the pay of the Chinese government, but how the rest of the world's media tends to be completely uncritical of the Dalai Lama and almost constantly in awe of him, as if he's just so wise and so special and so holy that the best we poor mortals can do is hope to catch a few pearls of his infinite wisdom as he passes by on his mission to save humanity. And you have to admit he does look very cute and very exotic with his bald head and funny glasses and purple robes, and all that Eastern mysticism just sounds so profound. And he did win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989, and he's a really big star, even in Hollywood, where he has lots of movie star devotees like Richard Gere and Steven Seagal. But unfortunately, that public image is about as far as most people's knowledge of the Dalai Lama goes, even amongst the LGBT community. And most LGBT people have the impression that the Dalai Lama, whose message is all about love, peace, and compassion, is on their side. So today on Reality Check, we're going to try to dig a little deeper and find out whether that's true or not. Now, of course, dealing with the Dalai Lama is a very complex issue, so I'm going to try to focus here on the man himself and what he specifically says and does. I'm not going to get into the whole thorny issue of Tibet and China, or even Buddhism in general, or Tibetan Buddhism in particular. I'm going to stick to His Holy Eminence himself. So the first thing to note about the Dalai Lama is that he's actually the 14th Dalai Lama. Most Tibetans believe, and he himself believes, that he is the latest reincarnation in a long line of Dalai Lamas stretching back over 600 years. The last Dalai Lama died in 1933, and the current one was born 18 months later in July 1935. And was recognized and proclaimed as the 14th Dalai Lama at the age of 2 in 1937. And he believes that, in fact, this is his 14th reincarnation as the Dalai Lama, and that all Dalai Lamas are themselves incarnations of the Bodhisattva of Infinite Compassion, Avalokiteshvara. By the way, dear listener, a bodhisattva is basically a person who has attained enlightenment or nirvana and seeks to use their wisdom to help others to become enlightened. And Avalokiteshvara is a particular bodhisattva that in China is normally depicted in female form as the goddess Kuan Yin. So the Dalai Lama really believes this. He talks about it on his website and even talks about his next reincarnation, his future reincarnation. He says, and I quote, "If the present situation regarding Tibet remains the same, I will be born outside Tibet, away from the control of the Chinese authorities." On his website, he also makes this rather strange comment, and I quote again, "Children are usually born with their eyes closed. I was born with my eyes open. This may be some slight indication of a clear state of mind in the womb." So that's what he believes. It may seem quite bizarre and far-fetched, but I guess it's just as valid as any other religious belief, not backed up by any evidence, which is pretty much the common thread of all religious beliefs. They're all based on faith, meaning they're all maintained without any evidence. Now let's have a look at some criticisms of the Dalai Lama, because you don't often hear him criticized, especially in the West. So it's always interesting when people do point out some of his faults. And I want to look today at two relatively recent examples of criticism, one by Christopher Hitchens and the other by John Safran. So probably the Dalai Lama's most famous critic is Christopher Hitchens, the British author and journalist, and one of the so-called New Atheists. Hitchens attacked the Dalai Lama in his 2007 book, God is Not Great, and also criticized him severely in a Salon.com article back in 1998. He criticized him most notably for supporting India's acquisition of nuclear weapons, but for a number of other reasons as well, including for banning in 1996 the worship of the Dorje Shugden deity, a type of god worshipped by many Tibetan Buddhists, which led to the intimidation and persecution of many of that deity's devotees. Hitchens also criticized the Dalai Lama for declaring the Hollywood action star and wealthy donor, Steven Seagal, for declaring him to be a tulku, that's a reincarnated 17th century lama from eastern Tibet called Chundrag Dorje. Yes, dear listener, Steven Seagal, star of such classic films as Hard to Kill and Marked for Death, is actually a reincarnated 17th century Buddhist holy man. Apparently Richard Gere was quite put out by this, thinking that he was the Hollywood favourite. Poor Ricky. But the criticism I want to focus on today is the one based on the Dalai Lama's views on sex, homosexuality, and masturbation, which are, maybe to the surprise of many LGBT people out there, about as conservative as the views of the Catholic Church, sometimes even more so. And it's those same teachings that the Australian TV and radio personality, John Safran, also focused on in a segment of his 2004 TV show called John Safran vs. God. In that segment, Safran took various quotes and teachings from the Dalai Lama about sexual prohibitions, read them to passers-by in the street, and asked them if they thought they had been said by the Pope or the Dalai Lama. Of course, everyone said the Pope, when the answer was always the Dalai Lama. And of course, the point of the skit was to show that while in the West, the Pope has an image of being much more authoritarian, reactionary, and dogmatic, and the Dalai Lama of being tolerant, liberal, and progressive, in many ways, the Dalai Lama's teachings are just as bad, if not worse, than those of the Pope. And the media is inconsistent in the way it treats the two figures. One could even call it a double standard. Let me go now through some specific quotes made by the Dalai Lama, some referred to by Hitchens and Safran, and others that I found separately. Now, the primary source for the Dalai Lama's teachings on sexual conduct is his 1996 book, Beyond Dogma. Let me quote the most relevant passage here. Now, the Dalai Lama is, of course, Tibetan, so I'm going to try to do it with my best Tibetan accent. The inappropriate parts of the body are the mouth and the anus, and sexual intercourse involving those parts of the body, whether with a man or a woman, is considered sexual misconduct. Masturbation as well. As for when sexual intercourse takes place, if it is during the day, it is also held to be a form of misconduct. A sexual act is deemed proper when the couple uses the organs created for sexual intercourse and nothing else. To have sexual relations with a prostitute paid by you and not by a third person does not, on the other hand, constitute improper behavior. Homosexuality, whether it is between men or between women, is not improper in itself. What is improper is the use of organs already defined as inappropriate for sexual contact. So did you get that? The only permitted sexual conduct is between a penis and a vagina. And that's okay, even if it's with a prostitute, but only if you paid him or her yourself. What's forbidden is oral and anal sex, as well as any sexual contact between two members of the same sex. And bizarrely enough, sex during the day is also forbidden. And of course, masturbation. Don't you just love religions that prohibit masturbation? I mean, really, some things just never cease to amaze me. Now, in 1997, at a press conference in San Francisco, the Dalai Lama said, and once again I quote, "From a Buddhist point of view, men to men and women to women is generally considered sexual misconduct. Even with your own wife, using one's mouth or the other hole is sexual misconduct. Using one's hand, that is sexual misconduct." He also added that sex with a prostitute is allowed as long as it's vaginal. By the way, when he says the other hole, he means the anus. He often refers to it like that for some reason. And there you go, once again, the explicit prohibition on masturbation. Giving oneself harmless pleasure is forbidden. Don't you just love these kinds of rules? In a 2001 interview with the French magazine Dimanche, when asked about homosexuality, the Dalai Lama said, and again I quote, "It's part of what we Buddhists call bad sexual conduct. Sexual organs were created for reproduction between the male element and the female element, and everything that deviates from that is not acceptable from a Buddhist point of view. Between a man and another man, a woman and another woman, in the mouth, the anus, or even using a hand." End quote. I also found a great quote from a 2006 interview with London's Daily Telegraph newspaper. When asked about homosexuality, the Dalai Lama says it's wrong, and went on to say, and I quote, full stop. No way around it. A gay couple came to see me, seeking my support and blessing. I had to explain our teachings. Another lady introduced another woman as her wife. Astonishing! End quote. Ha! Imagine that! A woman with a wife! Unbelievable! And they went to seek the blessing of the Dalai Lama! The nerve! Well, he taught them a thing or two. Now, the most recent quote I could find was from an interview he did with CBC News in Canada in 2007. In that interview, he stated that Buddhists reject homosexuality and condemn same-sex behavior as sexual misconduct. It is not permissible, not allowed. And the quotes go on and on. Every time the Dalai Lama has been asked about his opinion on homosexuality, it's been the same. It's sexual misconduct. And interestingly, the Dalai Lama also takes a strong position against abortion, calling it an act of killing. And in 1999, he officially endorsed the US anti-abortion lobby group called Consistent Life. Although in 1993, he did say that abortion would be okay if the unborn child will be mentally disabled or if the birth will create serious problems for the mother. So it probably comes as no surprise to learn that the Dalai Lama's comments on homosexuality have provoked quite a hostile reaction from certain members of the LGBT community. Which is why, on numerous occasions, he has had to clarify his position and make it clear that he doesn't condone violence against LGBT people and that he opposes discrimination against them. In 1997, a spokesperson for the Dalai Lama said, and I quote, "His Holiness opposes violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation. He urges respect, tolerance, compassion, and the full recognition of human rights for all." Which is pretty much what the Catholic Church says as well. In fact, when it comes to the issue of sexual misconduct or sexual sin, the Dalai Lama and the Pope toe a very similar line. They both spout dogmatic rules condemning anything that's non-procreative. And that's the root of the problem, as they see it, with homosexuality. The problem is not with same-sex attraction per se, but rather acting on that attraction, using the organs in a forbidden way. And then both of them follow up this dogmatic hard line with warm-sounding wishy-washy statements about kindness and compassion for all human beings. But such statements don't really help much. They don't undo the damage that the dogma causes and somehow make everything all better. Because you can't really go on about how bad homosexual conduct is and then think everyone will be nice to LGBT people anyway because you told them to be nice. Mixed messages like that are confusing to most people. And it's the core teachings themselves, the dogmatic rules that the Catholic priests or the Tibetan monks learn and then pass down to the wider societies, creating climates of homophobia, both amongst Catholic and Tibetan Buddhist societies. And this generalized homophobia creates a climate where discrimination and violence against LGBT people can occur. Just look at Latin America, for example, a very high level of Catholicism and an unfortunately high level of homophobic and transphobic violence. Now, I don't know any statistics on this amongst Tibetan communities, so I can't comment, But certainly the Dalai Lama's teachings don't really help to promote a safe and welcoming environment for LGBT people. Now, obviously, the equation between religious teachings and homophobic violence is not as simple as I've made out here, but I don't think that anyone can deny that religion does play a very important role in a society's acceptance of and feelings towards LGBT people. And just like the Pope's calls for everyone to love each other and live in peace and harmony don't go nearly far enough towards countering his specific dogma on homosexuality, I suspect that the Dalai Lama's broad statements about being kind to LGBT people don't really do much to counter the effect of the specific teachings on sexual misconduct. So what does all this mean? What's the reality check verdict on the Dalai Lama? That he's some kind of evil ogre going around deluding everybody into thinking he's actually nice? Just like the Pope? Well, no. Obviously, it's not that simple. Nor is it that simple in the case of the Pope either. And that's the whole point, really. The reality is much more complicated and nuanced than the media would tend to portray. The Dalai Lama certainly does a lot of good in the world. Anyone who campaigns as much as he does for world peace, non-violence, and harmony between the religions has to get an enormous amount of credit. The problem is the reverence and awe with which the Western media generally treat the Dalai Lama, because he's so wise and Eastern and exotic and, to them, impenetrable. When actually, he's just a religious and political leader like any other, like the Pope, for example, with numerous flaws and contradictions, good points and bad points, just like all the others. So he should be a target of fair and reasonable criticism, just as any other powerful person should be. Now, one final comment on the Dalai Lama. I think it's interesting to speculate on what people would say about the Dalai Lama today if history had been different and China had never invaded Tibet and he'd just become the absolute ruler of Tibet back in 1950. And if he was still in power today, 59 years later, and he ruled over a semi-feudal society where abortion and homosexuality were illegal. Now, that probably wouldn't be the case. Probably he would have made progress in introducing reforms and making Tibet a much better and much more just place than it used to be. But whatever he'd done, one suspects that if he were a political leader of Tibet holding actual power, he would be seen in a very different light than the one he's seen in today. Now, finally, before we get into our last song here on Reality Check, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's Tony, T-O-N-Y. You can also visit our webpage too, if you like. There you can find past episodes of Reality Check, and the address for that is realitycheckonline.net. All right, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was La Vida Es Un Carnaval by the legendary Cuban singer, the queen of salsa herself, Celia Cruz. Right, we're into the last section of Reality Check now, so that means it's time for our movie review. And this week we're going to tackle two new movies, Paranormal Activity and Antichrist, both films that have generated a lot of pre-release buzz, but for very different reasons. Now let's start with Paranormal Activity. The buzz around this film is that it was made for $15,000 by a small group of people with a video camera and has now earned over $100 million at the US box office alone, making it now the most profitable film of all time in terms of the percentage return on investment. Until now, that record was held by The Blair Witch Project, released in 1999, which was made for $60,000 and made a total worldwide box office of $249 million. Who knows what the worldwide box office takings of Paranormal Activity are going to be, but a handful of people are going to become very, very rich from this movie. I wish I were one of them. Well, now, actually, the comparison with The Blair Witch Project is very apt because, in my opinion, the movies are very, very similar. Both are based on the idea of found footage, that is, the characters themselves were doing the filming with their own camera, and we, the audience, are now just watching what they filmed. Both also follow a very similar narrative arc in which everything starts off rosy and then the situation gradually gets worse and worse for the characters as information about what's happening is gradually revealed until the predictably grim and terrifying ending. And both films rely much more on the fear of what's not seen to create suspense. A thud, a slight movement, or something not where it should be. These are the elements that create a mounting sense of imminent danger. And I have to say that Paranormal Activity does all this pretty effectively. Just suspend your disbelief and go along for the ride, and this can be a fun Friday night scary movie. I don't want to reveal too much about the plot here because I reckon this is the kind of movie where the less you know, the better, and try to avoid the trailer too if you can. All I'll say is that the movie was filmed entirely in one suburban American house. In fact, I've even heard one commentator call it the Blair House Project, which is actually pretty close to the mark. My main criticism of the film is that while it's pretty effective at sending chills down your spine, it really is very light and insubstantial and lacks any real depth, both in the main characters, which are just a generic young American couple, and in the plot, which really doesn't develop very much and ends up being quite repetitive. But having said that, Paranormal Activity is a perfectly acceptable option for a fun popcorn horror movie, particularly if the cinema is full and you get the added fun of the gasps and shrieks of the audience around you. Now, our second movie up for review tonight is Antichrist. And actually, it's interesting to review it along with Paranormal Activity and compare the two. Because although the two films could be loosely described as horror, they would come at completely opposite ends of the genre. Whereas Paranormal Activity is a first-time feature made with handheld video camera, relies on just bumps and noises for its horror, and is a fun, shallow, and ultimately quickly forgettable, well, Antichrist is the opposite of all these things. Antichrist is the latest from the seasoned Danish film director Lars von Trier. The cinematography is rich, varied, and at times breathtakingly beautiful. And it is also extremely graphically gruesome and violent. And far from being a light popcorn flick with superficial characters, this is an extremely dense, cerebral, disturbing film about serious subjects full of symbolism and with very complex characters. In Paranormal Activity, what you see is what you get. Two people in a house getting scared. Antichrist, however, is deliberately confounding, provocative, harrowing, and at times just obscure, and is a film that will be studied and talked about by cultural theorists, feminists, and film critics for years to come. Yet, come to think of it, both Paranormal Activity and Antichrist are both, in a way, more than just films. They're kind of events in the history of cinema. Paranormal Activity, for the huge amount of money it's made out of virtually nothing, and Antichrist for reaching new heights of on-screen sex, violence, and sheer provocation of the viewer. Antichrist caused an uproar when it screened at the Cannes Film Festival in May this year, with some critics booing at the end and others applauding. Some were too shocked to do anything. It quickly gained a reputation for being one of the most controversial films ever screened at the festival, and generated even more publicity when Lars von Trier, at a press conference, declared himself to be the best film director in the world. And you know what, dear listener? I actually agree with that statement. Lars von Trier is my favorite film director. That, however, doesn't mean that I enjoyed Antichrist. In fact, I didn't really enjoy it. It's certainly an interesting film, certainly an important film, even an historic one, but definitely not enjoyable. It's really just grim, perplexing, excruciating, and at times tedious. And even though Lars von Trier's films normally deal with characters facing a hopeless situation that just goes from bad to worse with no chance of escape, at least there's usually a sense of wit and humour behind it all. Because we all know that the film is really just a way to mock the puritanism or the hypocrisy or the hubris of those who are doing the persecution. But apparently Lars von Trier wrote Antichrist in the midst of a period of deep depression. And I have to say, it shows. There's really not the slightest sense of fun in this movie. No knowing winks to the audience. Look how silly these people really are. Antichrist is just bleak, violent, and ultimately draining. The story is about a couple grieving the loss of a child who go to stay in a cabin deep in the woods, where the man, a trained counselor, can continue the therapy he's giving to his partner to help her get through the grief. Things don't go as smoothly as hoped for, though, and in the last quarter of the movie, things turn extremely nasty indeed. Now, there is so much to say about Antichrist, we could talk about it and debate it for a whole show or more. But we don't have much time here, so I'll just make a few brief comments. The first 5 minutes of the movie, the prologue, all filmed in black and white and in ultra slow motion is some of the most stunningly beautiful cinematography I've ever seen. And interestingly, it features an explicit shot of an erect penis entering a vagina, which I have to say I was very heartened to see, because here in Australia, where we have a draconian censorship system, those kinds of shots are normally obligatorily cut from movies that get a cinema release. Maybe the censorship board is finally loosening up a little bit. Let's hope so. And actually, that's not the last time you'll see an erect penis or a vagina in this movie. But the next time you see them will be under much more grim circumstances. My second comment is that in Antichrist, Lars von Trier has brought to the silver screen one of the most menacing and terrifying psycho nutcases since Jack Nicholson played Jack Torrance in The Shining. I'm not going to reveal here who the psycho is, because that's one of the twists in the plot, but when the psycho starts getting to work, believe me, you don't want to be anywhere nearby. And the final question is, what is Antichrist really all about? Well, hard to say. Clearly, it's about misogyny. Some critics have also said the movie itself is misogynistic, and I can easily understand why they would say that. It's also about nature, both in the sense of the forest and the fight for survival in the natural world, and in the sense of human nature and its deepest, darkest secrets. It's also about religion, I guess, that's clear from the title and the numerous references to Satan. And it's about grief and, well, lots of other themes, some of them not really clear. The movie is full of lots of bizarre symbolism. The deer, the crow, the talking fox, the blood-sucking ticks, the naked bodies in the roots of the tree, the faceless girls at the end. Sometimes it's all a bit surreal, and it becomes clear that you're watching an art movie. And frankly, I don't really know what it all means, and I suspect that Lars von Trier doesn't really know either. Or if he does, he'll never explain it. He'll just leave that to the critics and the theorists who, I have a feeling, will be debating and arguing over this film for many years to come. And that brings us to the end of the 18th episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 10 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 19. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.